you go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, yeah. Left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
It's society. They work for each other, they pay each other, they buy houses, they get married, make children.
That just sounds like slavery with extra steps.
I don't know if you've noticed, but our two-party system is a bowl of shit looking in the mirror at itself.
I can't wait for the episode of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire where all the contestants team up and they overpower the host and they share the money.
The message of Occupy Wall Street is I would prefer not to play the existing game.
We are a socialist party and there are social solutions to the problems.
Communal lifestyles, I don't know about that.
No one can tell me what to do.
Wow, you're a real anarchist.
And now we had a king. I thought we were an autonomous collective.
No words for you puppets of the West. Communism forever.
God, those communists are amazing.
Hello, and welcome to the Three Left Show, your show for news analysis and potpourri from the radical left for a post-capitalist present and future. I'm Dan Platt, and with me in the studio is Colin.
Colin Abley. Hello. Good
welcome,
morning.
Welcome. We're feeling good this week. I'm a little pumped. So we got a lot of things to go through today. The first half of the show will be focused on electoral politics.
It's an election year.
Stay focused, but also, well, midterms, whatever.
Study up for those midterms.
I didn't know this, but elections are every year. There are elections every year.
Every November.
If you didn't know. And then the second half of the show, we're focused on environmentalism, or rather deep ecology, how capitalism prevents any kind of actual environmentalism from happening, touch on green capitalism, which I've done before, but obviously we'll continue to do, and lawns, and how to have more ecological landscaping around you, even if you don't own a lawn. But first, I wanted to get at that next week, there's going to be, so this is technically a new story as well.
It's going down.
Yeah, so there's Unite the Right Part 2 in Charlottesville, in D.C. It's a one-year anniversary of last year's incident/clash between Antifa and the far nationalist, Dump Lords? Yeah, Dump Lords.
We can't call them what we'd usually call them on the radio.
But I think there are other things we can call people instead of just swearing and using other kind of ableist
just terrible
words.
People.
Yeah.
Terrible people with awful ideology.
Yeah, we don't have to use liberal names either, like deplorables, because, you know, they're easily adoptable. They're not bad enough. Like, you know, you're not going to call yourself a dump lord. So,
Well, they're Nazis, you know. That's yes. Literally, like, we're not being facetious or hyperbolic here. Like, the people doing this Unite the Right thing are modern-day fascists. And that's what they call themselves, and they're proud of it.
And we make no apologies for fighting them. So, but anyway, my mission will be a defensive one, because I'm going down not alone, but with a group of other like-minded, at the moment, just armchair socialists, but they want to get their feet wet, say that they participated in a direct action. They want to see what it's really like, and they also just don't want to say they're all talk. I don't think anyone wants to do that, unless they're a coward of some type. But anyway, these guys, they want to do more, and so at least we'll be defensive, we'll be in the back, and also, the mission is defensive in the first place. So in Charlottesville, the student union there of the college is going to have a big vigil for Head or Higher and just the cause in general, anti-fascist messaging. And we're going to go down there to support them and if necessary, protect them. But it's a numbers game. If you have more numbers, the fash back off. They will only jump you. Just like kind of like with any kind of thing that you might be fearful of other people attacking you randomly.
They don't fight fair.
Doesn't happen unless that's why it's just a numbers game.
And so, this time, I think the reason a lot of people are going down this year is because they saw what happened last year and it was just an absolute disaster.
Right.
There were all those. That's where you had the Tiki Torch Nazis show up. And there were only like a couple of dozen people. I remember seeing a YouTube video of someone just going, you know, totally losing his mind that there were only a few dozen people there in front of a memorial shouting, no fascist, no KKK, no racist.
That's the chant, yeah.
Yes. And
no racist USA.
The Nazis there were I think, emboldened by the fact that so few people showed up. I mean, we didn't know how many of them would show up.
True.
But this year, we know that something is going down.
You know exactly how many are showing up because it will be less than last time. Because in the last year, preceding year, they have had their own infighting, their own struggles, because Antifa has been winning.
Yes.
Some said there was the setback in Portland, but that was basically what's left of their movement. And so that same group there, that number there, is what's going to be showing up. So it's just a matter of having more of our side, the Antifa, which is a coalition of even liberals and other social democrats with far left like us, to just get the fash back in the closet, as it were.
And it's great how, you know,
which moves the Overton window at the very least towards the center, which can then move to the left. But, you know, it's, yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully all this outright right-wing organizing results in a kind of backlash, and it moves some people in the center to realize that you can't be in the middle on this. You have to, at least, even if you are all talk, even if you are someone like me who can't put themselves in bodily risk for that, you know, the people who do talk the talk, it's great to see comrades going down there and backing things up with action and taking that kind of risk. I think it's very heroic. Mm-hmm. I think it's a huge risk.
Not the kind of we need to kill ourselves.
No, it's not foolhardy. You know, you don't
heroicism of the Nazis.
Well, it is an act of self-defense to show up against the fascists, because the fascists are aggressors. Yeah. Even in their speech, are aggressors. The whole point of their ideology is that only one race and one gender is legitimate and should have power over everybody else. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they actively want things like genocide, like eugenics, and mass executions. It's terrible. They are, you know, we don't need to use words that are ableist at all. This is just terrible and wrong, and it needs to be faced up to, because we've seen in history when you allow this sort of thing to just go unaddressed, and when the left is not united, is what happened in places like Italy and Germany last century. We can't have that happen again here.
I watched a very particular good YouTube mini doc by Peter Coughlin. This is the name of the YouTube channel as well. And it's basically, he explains point by point that why you any kind of rhetoric about overpopulation is inherently eugenics. This is something like a lot of people find hard to believe, because they hear overpopulation so incessantly in major publications, like, oh, is overpopulation a problem? But that question, if you trace back its origins of when it's always discussed, it's always in the context, and it goes all the way back to Malthus, of basically strangling the poor to make sure that the well-off stay well-off.
Yes.
So it's always about privilege. It's always about crushing others for your benefit. And it's always about who is choosing who is disposable.
Yes, it's not...
That is not a democratic... That is not a question that is answered democratically.
No, and it's...
Even though liberals seem to think it would be.
Yeah, it's not a problem. The world doesn't have a problem of overpopulation of any group of people. The problem is that too few people have too much wealth and are hoarding it and keeping it away from the working classes that produced that wealth and who deserve a better slice of it. You know,
yeah,
it's not that the world is half full of super poor people, because these are people who just have no brains and don't know how to become wealthy. And so they just produce more offspring, right? Capitalism wants them to produce those offspring to then exploit their labor. And extract the wealth that they produced and go back to the 1%, the 0.1%, the 0.0001% that owns so much that they don't even know what to do with.
Which, if the Wall Street Journal and other, and Forbes are to be believed, the financial reporters, that we've had all of this population growth, but there's all these labor shortages because us millennials haven't been trained properly, and we're not also interested in doing their crappy work. So I'll cover this another show. Yeah, so I'll just let it lie. But otherwise, like, you know, millennials are killing X industry and Y industry. We're not educated properly. Well, you know, if that was the case, why didn't the Wall Street Journal make a Wall Street Journal for kids and put it in the schools and like Time just, did? I mean, why are they only complaining now that we're not supportive of their system?
There's a glaring contradiction here to say that the millennial generation is not educated enough. Okay, you can't say that on the one hand.
We weren't educated the right way is what they mean.
While on the other hand, we have a massive student debt problem.
Yeah.
You know, we are the most in-debt generation that there's ever been because we were sold the idea, if you go to school, higher education is your ticket to the upper class. And that's not the way it works.
And we covered before the stats that liberal arts degrees are actually the far, far minority. Most degrees are in business and the kind of career path that's supposed to, at least in theory, neoliberal theory, get you a job. Position in a corporate, a big firm, and of course it didn't deliver.
No, what gets you jobs in the higher echelons into the oligarchy, essentially, that's what these corporations are. They are the true rulers of the country. What gets you in there are things like connections, family connections that you have because you're already upper class, being members of secret society, going to the correct public school.
You don't have to call it a secret society because it's not very secret.
That's true.
But I will, in a previous episode, I made the mistake of trying to refute meritocracy. Now, there are arguments against meritocracy, but actually the heart of it is I don't really need to do that, and I don't need to, and I shouldn't, or it's not necessary because meritocracy itself is a myth, it has never existed. Now, maybe there's pockets of it here and there, maybe in the state, you know, but not really. You're hired by the state also based on recommendations, and you're passed up based on your ability to follow orders, which I wouldn't really call very merit. I mean, it's also a question of what is merit. If you're talking about art, well, or other subjective things, I mean, most things are, you know, how good are you at this particular job is not always something that can be put into a statistical form, especially if it's how well you communicate. You know, is it on a scale of 1 to 10? That's, you know, it's very odd stuff. Yeah. So, but then there's also a point about inequality in general and the source of it that I was coming to this week of, as I was thinking in my head about stuff, about, and how to better explain, the greater structural, the systematic problems and a narrative that fits so people do not go into the identitarian narratives of, you know, it's so simple that it's just a black versus white or a male versus female or rich versus poor even. But let's say, but I want to point out that it's the profit motive, or rather the need for profit. So whenever any profit is extracted, be it like, you know, when you're not paid an amount, basically anytime there's profit extraction, there needs to be a profit that is stealing. You know, taxes are theft, property is theft. What does it mean by that? Or rent is theft. What is meant? That any profit is something that's being stolen. Now, it's a necessary theft because everyone needs to steal a little bit from each other to have the net. Otherwise, but why? Because at the very, you follow up the exchanges of rent seeking and profit making. Eventually, you get to banks and them making money for a profit. Meaning, by making money, I mean literally they loan out the money for a profit. Thus, every small business has to steal from their workers, and then every worker has to steal in a more less legal fashion, in a way. So it's everyone has to steal because there is at the 1% steal the most. And they, capitalists in general, not as people but as a class, steal from the environment, which we will discuss.
Yep.
But they steal from the earth. They steal from not only people, but everything else. So it's all, the whole economy is based on a basic level of theft. Now, if you take profit, that need for a net off, then everything becomes a net, just needing to get net. You know, that's where me paying rent for my housing, it isn't really abusive. I am just paying for the cost of the heating, the utilities, and the maintenance. Imagine that. And the only reason the person doing the maintenance, say the landlord, the person managing it, who hopefully would live nearby, needs to live nearby or live in the same complex, they only need to charge more for, you know, for rent to make the profit more than just the cost of maintaining it, because they're paying a taxes, which is then rent to the municipality, and then rent to the bank in the form of a mortgage. And even when you pay off your mortgage, you usually refinance, so then you can have money to do other things in your life, right, like send your kids,
you borrow against your house
to for healthcare and education and all the things that are not rights. That sound like a good explanation.
That sounds like a good explanation, and it also sounds, I say this all the time to people who are right there. I'd be like, I'm very, very good. You get the general, you are seeing that things like profit is kind of stealing away from, but why? You know, what's the reason for this? And my answer is always going to be the same, is just go out to the bookstore, get yourself a copy of Capital Volume 1 and struggle with it. The first three chapters take things as to why things have a different value and why there are contradictions between things like publicly made production for private profit, or how everything...
What's public production? The
fact that production is social, that we produce commodities...
Social production.
For social use. And where, you know, profit comes from.
Then that'd be a public sector.
Going through Marx's Capital will teach you things like why there is a necessary socially necessary labor time put into every product that we pay more for, because every product has a use value for what it's designed for, and then an exchange value on the market that goes to a universal equivalent, which is money. Capital explains in the first few chapters, and it kind of has to build the starting base for the rest of the argument as it expands dialectically. What is a commodity? What is use value and exchange value?
Too.
What is money? A lot of people, money is what makes the world go round. There's a great song in the show Chicago. But
that's not Chicago. That's or is Mike
it
Python.
Cabaret, I think it is, actually.
Oh, Cabaret, yes, that one.
We're getting our musicals mixed up. But what is money? You know, what is this stuff? What is this stuff that we buy stuff with, that we get paid with, that we pay rent for? What is this stuff that is profit? And what happens when that profit then gets used simply for the production of more of it?
Which is only based on debt.
What is capital? Mm-hmm. Yes, and it is based on debt.
And basing it on gold doesn't really help.
And from these ideas, from what Marx is understanding, one of the things that Marx did as a philosopher that very few people had done before him, if at all, was look to what's going on underneath all of this stuff without recourse to metaphysical things like goodness and evil and God and Satan.
Having to moralize.
That's
what he would call idealism and other types like him.
When he found Hegel sitting on his head and turned him right side up.
Mm-hmm. So I'm tempted to let you have like a capital segment every week, but I also want to point out, if you're interested, but also there's Zero Books is doing their newest few videos have actually been about explaining capital chapter by chapter, with 10-minute videos that are very entertaining. And there are a few other YouTube channels like one's called Randian Pi, that's Randian like the radius of a circle. But Randian.
Not Randian like I'm
no,
Randian.
No, Radian. Who we hate. Sorry, it's
okay.
Radian.
Okay, good.
Like the radius of a circle with an N. Pi, 2 pi or something like that. And they've made condensed versions of these chapters, which are sort of pretty much digestible. They're just explanations like the one you just gave, but even maybe a little more explanatory.
Yeah. I made it through the book.
Scripted.
I only made it through the book by watching the lectures of CUNY CUNY professor by the name of David Harvey, who has been teaching the book for about 40 years, and he put his lectures online for free.
Yeah, it's like Shakespeare. You know, you need to be talking about it with other people.
Yes, it's very difficult.
Because it took him a decade to write it, at least.
It took Marx never finished Capital.
Well, it's part one, which is kind of why it's, since there isn't a part two,
Well, there is volume two, and I've learned that there's three volumes were published, and then there's kind of a fourth volume that is just called the Economic and Political Manuscripts. And then there's the Grundrisse, Grundrisse was kind of a formative document, but really Marx's idea like was huge, and it's probably larger than anybody else could have finished in a lifetime, and that's why we have Marxism, which goes further on from the basic ideas that Marx expounded, takes the dialectical materialism,
like Darwinism or Einsteinism, that we don't call all the astrophysics Einsteinism,
the continental philosophers that followed after Nietzsche and Freud.
Yeah, so it's not political ideology as much as a range of thinking about problems. So that's something to clarify. So we got our philosophical jibber jabber out of the way. So now we can go right to. So we're based in Albany, New York, but I think we're going to discuss things and stories that do affect the rest of the country. You want to start with the governor's race?
Yeah, I think, you know, as much as we kind of bemoan the fact that electoral politics is just a bourgeois trap, there are some people, you know, running who I think are good. And we have news from my party, the Socialist Party, mm-hmm. is that we talked with Howie Hawkins, mm-hmm. the Green candidate for governor. And after pushing him to kind of use the word socialist a little bit more often in his literature and his talks, and point out that he is a member of the party is endorsing him. So as a member of the Socialist Party, we are encouraging people to vote for Howie for governor. And
Did this happen 4 years ago as well, though, didn't it?
I really don't know. I came to the Socialist Party this year. And
that's right.
So this is new for you. This is new for me.
But I believe four years ago, we did the same thing, had the same process where it's been in the last 4 years that the Green Party has been able to assert we are eco-socialists, that even the Times, we'll cover that in a moment, will admit we have a, you know, we put out that we're anti-capitalist, or rather the wording is post-capitalist, like the one I use for this show, uh-huh. which can mean various different things. The point is that it's not what we have now. So if we want alternatives, we can discuss that. How anarchistic is it? How state-based is it? These are things to figure out in the movement in this time.
It's indicative that what we have now isn't working. I think that's fundamental idea number one. What we have is capital, number one. We have capitalism. That's the economic system. Nobody's going to argue with that. What people do argue about...
No, some people do.
Oh, I know.
They say it's crony capitalism.
They have to admit that their idealized vision of capitalism isn't what we have. Something is, number one, the thing that just about everybody agrees on, except the extremely well-off, something is wrong and needs fixing. Mm. So even if you start, like, you're not going to hear this from me very often, but even those people who say, oh, it's crony capitalism, or it's the cabal, it's oligarchic capitalism, it's authoritarian capitalism, those people are at least, they've at least got one little toe in the water. I mean, they take it out.
They just have to not say that it's a particular group of people who are making it crony capitalism, the Jews.
Yes, and that's, you know, this is where the fascists come in.
It's me, guys. Yeah. I'm the one doing it. Sorry.
It's all me and all
the other Jews.
It's all Dan's fault. And I mean, that's totally wrong, but at least, you know, it shows you how powerful the idea is connected to the reality that it really is a group of people, the capitalist class, as a class themselves, the bourgeoisie, that is causing these problems. So when
they're a clique like any other clique, but so and they have egos and whatever.
Using words like post-capitalist and anti-capitalist and socialist in any way, shape, or form, this is kind of a backpedaling on myself. I have party members who, when they hear the word democratic socialist, like Bernie Sanders or Alexandria or Ocasio-Cortez, they get all upset. They're like, "Oh, socialism is inherently democratic." Democratic socialism is a tautology.
But it's
you shouldn't
it's
say
accurate,
democratic
though.
Socialism because it undermines the socialist movement.
Sure.
I disagree. Yeah. I am ready to sit here and say, you know what? Even in our party literature, the Socialist Party USA is a democratic socialist organization, and we conduct ourselves that way. Mm-hmm. And that is
just means the words just mean different things.
It's a step in the right direction to get people using this language. So I'm very glad
that
the Hawkins campaign is using eco-socialist. Like Yeah, even if you have to add a qualifier to socialist.
Cool. It does is it means that radio show hosts, like the ones he appears on when he's invited, and that's something we actually have to fight to get him on the air sometimes, mm-hmm. like with the local public radio affiliate. And they will ask him, what does he mean by, like, are you anti-capitalist? Are you this? And he's like, well, we're about moving beyond it and helping ensure worker rights.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. So, so another endorsement that occurred with the governor's race here in New York, which has some import, but also because
this is kind
hell,
of
if Ocasio-Cortez is national news and everyone buzzes about her, they should be able to buzz about a governor's race, even though usually people don't.
This is not so good news. This is
okay. So you can explain to me why it isn't, and then we'll expand
it's
on it together.
It's okay news. It's news that makes me go.
It's fine.
It's fine.
It's fine.
And it indicates where we're at. Where the left, even the quote unquote baby left, is at. Mm-hmm. So,
we mean that with love.
Yes,
they're not we like love, we don't. Yeah, does babe? It could be seen a
babies
taken as
need to be cared for and loved and taught things
nurtured
and nurtured. Yes,
it's kind of infantilizing.
But
though.
Sometimes babies do
we
stuff.
We don't want consent.
Sometimes they do stuff that they know is naughty, and they learn that it's naughty by you scolding them a little bit. So this is a little bit of a wag.
Can you be a little
finger.
More condescending, Colin? So, I don't think that was enough.
So. To get the metaphor out of the way.
I like a different term than baby leftist.
We talked a couple weeks ago about...
Junior leftist,
yes.
Apprentice leftist.
Yep.
Nah, that's too long.
But Cynthia Nixon came out a couple weeks ago as a democratic socialist. She described herself as such.
Oddly, right after Ocasio-Cortez won her congressional race.
Right after that big primary win.
Funny
and
that.
And all the media attention that got... Deservedly so, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And Cynthia Nixon wanted to go before the Democratic Socialists of America, our friends, and mm-hmm. I would say, yeah, comrades.
They helped. They helped get her the win.
Wanted DSA's endorsement, and it turns out that DSA down in New York City has given it to her. They've endorsed
by some margin.
They've endorsed Cynthia Nixon. I believe it was very close. I believe there were a lot of DSA folks who are more radical left in their politics that were like, no way. She's just, and I mean, it's very obvious. Cynthia Nixon is not a very polished politician, okay, right? She's much more of just a rich actress, activist. Her instincts really aren't that great.
She quotes Reagan with that, you know, it really helps that I am an actress and that Reagan himself said, I can't imagine you being a politician not being an actor.
Yeah.
All of our politics should just be actors representing policies or just by their personality. I mean, that's personality-based mm-hmm. politics, and it's not about the policy. Now, Cortez won in a combination of the policy, but also because of who she is, being a Puerto Rican young woman, that also energized people as well, which also is kind of a problem, but... it shouldn't matter, but also it does because Democrat, you know, and so on.
But I think that what the lesson to
we
be
want
learned,
to be intersectional, and you know, we should be.
Yes, and the lesson to be learned here that this shows is that this is one of the outgrowths of the Sanders 2016 campaign. I think it will continue to grow if, or perhaps when, Senator Sanders declares another presidential run. We'll see what happens. I think he's gonna. He'd be a fool not to, actually.
Yeah, you said that before.
But he has popularized the term Democratic Socialist to the extent that noob politicians who want a constituency of support will call themselves this, even mm-hmm. if their policies don't line up, even if they're just barely there, and they will seek the endorsement of Democratic Socialists of America. That means that Democratic Socialists of America has at least a little bit of this wonderful stuff called political power.
Now, I want to point out that with Nixon, her campaign and platform is socially democratic or democratic social. Social democrat just refers to New Deal programs and policies, and plus the things that have occurred since then, like
and the shift in our political
decriminalizing
language.
Drugs and so on.
Yeah, this is now called democratic socialism in America.
Right. So, and there's the rhetoric of what she's selling, the platform, but then her staff and her advisors are all de Blasio people.
Mm-hmm.
So just like with de Blasio, who wasn't actually the most progressive candidate in that primary, the Democratic primary, which he won, there was the treasurer was actually the most progressive because he was the one who was actually using the public financing. And but then things went awry because of public financing in New York City is so complex and just bad. It doesn't work well. Why? Because taxpayers don't want money going to the wrong candidates. Like Lou, which was his name. So he was an Asian American. Anyway, de Blasio won. And what did he do as mayor? He's been as neoliberal as ever. I mean, he's not a Republican, whatever. He's not Bloomberg. But it was all talk. His housing policy has been gentrification on steroids. That's the main thing to throw out, that you can have new politicians, as you put them, or other established people, whether they be actors or people who have been in government for a long time, switch sides, as it were, and you see that as a victory. But really, it's on paper. It's in the paper. But in the background, it's the same old, same old. It's just the new rebranding. Okay.
Yeah.
And that's like, so how do you tell when an organization is just rebranding, like when the Democratic Party says it's a big tent that, you know, will allow certain districts and areas to be more progressive, and organizations that are not? I think it's just a matter of paying attention to any reporting you can muster about the money. Where is it getting its funding? You know,
that's what
grassroots organizations that are funded with the small D donations, they can be trusted. You know, the Sanders campaign had the integrity as far as its own operations were concerned, but then it's doing its overall strategy of running within the Democratic Party. Well, they will be cheated and they will be blocked and sabotaged.
And I think that's a good thing because people will then see what kind of organization the Democratic Party actually is. That is, we say it over and over again, it's the graveyard of social movements. It tricks you. It gets you thinking we're a two-party system, so you need to pick one. The Democrats are slightly more to the left than the Republicans. They're a center-right party instead of a right-outright party.
I don't want to wait another, like, 6 years, though.
Oh, we're going to have to wait a long time, man.
Yeah.
This
is the lesson people should have gotten after 06. So, like we were mentioning off-air about that, you mentioned an article, and then there's plenty of reporting on this about... And you can just see it in the daily news if you pay attention. There was a blue wave in 06.
Yep, I remember and it very well.
It meant Jack and it meant Jack. And because most of them, half of them were the blue dogs, conservative Democrats that were actually Republican light. If anything, they were Republicans that just had a D next to their name because they were pro-abortion and anti-civil rights. And they didn't fight an iota about allowing actually people to vote.
No,
because the general gripe about the election system is it is created and maintained to serve, or rather to function for, older conservative voters.
And big business.
Yeah, so, right, at the behest of big business. So the media on one end talk about the energy and the passion of young people that are a majority not supportive of capitalism and all of these democratic socialists. But then the leadership, as I reference here, where Perez, chair of the Democratic DNC, is saying that Cortez is the future of our party, but by referring to young people. Now, why does he say this? Because his daughter is a fan.
Mm-hmm.
And
Perez was the establishment choice. Against the more progressive Keith Ellison, who had the Bernie-crats support.
Perez has just also the DNC... themselves have endorsed Cuomo in the governor's race as well.
Because Cuomo is Mr. Establishment. You can't find anybody more establishment than Andrew Cuomo.
So the two things put out in this article, the Business Insider, okay. So I'm going to use some voices of the establishment when I'm talking about what the establishment's doing.
Sure.
With their rebranding efforts and whatnot. So the two things that are pointed out, on Perez, so there's Perez's side, which wants to be cool and hip with the kids, referring to the Dem Party as a big tent, and we can have ideological diversity, even though the whole party itself is funded by the 1%. And then there's a localism/regionalism argument that Well, she's right for her district. Now, Dems like this, this is not a winning strategy in the Midwest, even though polling would say that the people in the Midwest are supportive of social democracy.
I mean, it's ridiculous. The Midwest, historically, in American history, has been a hotbed of union activity and socialist politics winning elections a century ago. The Midwest, saying that...
Things shifted in the 70s, though. With neoliberalism. But anyway, like the book What's the Matter with Kansas by Tom Frank, I think, explores that. Mm-hmm. Of how Republicans came to dominate these... It was once the Democratic hotbed, you know, all the yeoman farmers and so on. But basically everything was consolidated, so now it's just a few big companies that control everything, and everyone else is basically their serfs to some extent. Until their farm goes under and they're bought out, and then they have to move to some trailer park and then they're told they're white trash and it's all their fault.
Individualized.
But they didn't vote for the free trade the first time. Okay, maybe they voted for Republicans later who just support free trade. Oh, because the Democrats support free trade. Mm-hmm. So there's really no real choice in the first place. Right. So it's like don't blame. You know, it's not the blaming of individual voters. Total bunk. So another story related to this was, okay, so on the one hand, so you have Perez and also other Democratic leaders like Pelosi saying like, oh, it's not indicative, shut up. And not so fast, we don't want to go too far left, we won't win, all these other areas where, you know, we just need to do, freaking outreach. So anyway, but on the other side of it, also from, let's see, what is this from? This is Politico, voice of the establishment. It's a significant shift in our thinking. Business takes a fresh look at Democrats.
Shiny and new.
All of these one percenters or associations of them, including, let's see, what was one? The main one is literally like a banking conglomerate of like a Association of Bankers, U.S. Chamber of Congress.
Yeah,
so all these people usually donate to Republicans, but of course they donate to both parties, but more so to Republicans because they're just consistently pro-business instead of just maybe sometimes Democrats can be coaxed into supporting workers or at least talking like they support workers. And that itself is bad because it gets people funny ideas that maybe they could be represented. Even the Koch brothers, the powerful Koch network. And so it's not just two people. It's also all of their...
Those evil Koch brothers.
Executives and all the people who work under them who are also rich as hell. Democrats... Americans for Prosperity President Tim Phillips said at a donor retreat Monday that the political network would not help Kramer, Republican of North Dakota, in a Senate race against Democratic incumbent. This is because some Republicans are coming out against free trade because Trump is.
Yes.
Why was Trump? Because he picked up that people are, in fact, upset that the jobs were went overseas.
And I can't stand saying this about Mr.
Trump. And made the lower class of...
It was politically astute of him. Mm-hmm. To go after the free trade deals that people know were bad for them.
Yeah.
That the Clintons got started. And that Bush continued and Obama continued and all the politicians continued. So the people, the dispossessed people of middle America in the Rust Belt were like, well, we know that Ms. Clinton is going to keep on with this stuff. And this Trump buffoon is the only guy saying anything about it. We're going to hold our nose and take a chance on him. That's why the 2016 election was lost. Mm.
Perhaps starting with what could be seen as the nihilistic hopelessness of the electoral situation, but we're kind of edging at just general critiques of the system that until it's the whole system. So like when we were talking about free trade, free trade can't be revoked because as long as we're in late capitalism, as we are, it can't work any other way, right? You know, in order for there to be any profits or growth whatsoever to keep our currency from going defunct, jobs did need to be outsourced. We do need to import and export at the rates we currently are.
Labor rates were cheaper in foreign countries.
Right. So
therefore you can when
we do actually impose tariffs again, I don't know how this is even happening. I think it's just by executive order or something. Because the trade deals haven't been revoked or whatever, renegotiated as Trump would probably make people think he's doing. It caused it's creating a sort of a cataclysm, and all of the farming sector needs to be resubsidized or oversubsidized because they're behind on the trade.
Yep.
They can't export at the same rate because it's literally a matter of like the tariff is up 2%. That means 2% less exports. And that's 2%. And that's like sometimes the margins on a farmer is that 2%. And they're going to all go out of business. These are, you know, the whole dairy industry in New York is completely subsidized. They couldn't function otherwise. And so on. It's the whole, we could go into deep, you know, I would like to have an actual economist on to talk about how that works. So, but otherwise I'll just hint at it can't stand on its own. This whole, like, you know, yes, working hard is all that's needed. No, it is not. Hard work is just being a cog in the late capitalist machine. And why talk about it this way? To get the idea in people's heads, in your head, or to discuss, systemic solutions are needed for systemic problems. This is not something that can be voted away. It's not something that can, you know, you elect the right people,
yeah,
and they incrementally take steps to solve it and renegotiate this deal and that. No, it has to be completely changed.
And every generation of voters has to learn this lesson, and it takes years. This is why we were talking about the blue wave in 06.
Has it ever been learned, though? I mean, maybe it's been learned by us.
I mean, I'm here, and I'm in my mid-30s. When I was in my 20s and I was just starting to pay attention to politics, mm-hmm. 06 was new, and I saw that blue wave, and I was like, okay, good. Mm-hmm. All our problems, you know, these guys will stand up to Bush, and we'll have mm-hmm. better progress. You know, I was hopeful in 08 when Obama won. I thought that universal health care was going to happen. And none of it did.
Or something like it.
And it made me step away and grow disenchanted. And it made me seek out explanations as to why things were here. And I came to leftism, Marxism, and socialism.
Yeah.
And now I understand how the world actually works. And so a lot of what you saw with Bernie Sanders was very much the hope of Obama just 8 years later. But with a guy who actually kind of believed in some kind of pseudo-leftist politics. And I don't think, you know, one of the reasons that we're even kind of wasting our time on electoral politics in 2018 is because we've got these democratic socialists, people who call mm-hmm. themselves that, doing better than expected. And that mm-hmm. creates a kind of bellwether. Like if Cynthia Nixon can even get on the ballot, that's a bellwether. Against a guy like Andrew Cuomo, you couldn't ask for a better like control group to test the hypothesis. Mm-hmm. How well does democratic socialism do against neoliberalism?
Can you translate the actual anger and frustration with a Republican like Cuomo, who sells himself as a Democrat? And I see these Facebook ads. They are ads that are liked by people I know. And it's like, gay marriage, $15 minimum wage. Like, this is the progress that Andrew Cuomo delivers.
$15 minimum wage in like a few years graduated.
Oh, and even then, it's like, but it's not $15 upstate here.
Nope.
It's going to be $12.50, which is...
By the time it gets to $15, it's going to need to go up again.
I already feel like I'm underpaid and I'm getting $11.
Yeah,
and
it's peanuts. Just, peanuts. It's
I can't keep up with, you know, I mean, I don't feel like I'm keeping up
with bills. It's basically red meat to throw the... more left liberal base.
So to go back to this political thing where, to wrap up, that the 1%, the rich, are shifting some of their control of our government to the moderate Dems. Now, they're already bought, but, I mean, they're just going to consolidate that control, I suppose.
Yeah, they're losing control of this Tea Party Republican Freedom Caucus.
And also expand the amount of moderate Dems so that a majority, if not all, of the Congressional Caucus of the Democrats are moderate. So instead of just 10 Democratic senators voting for everything that Trump wants, it will be 15 or 20.
Yeah, they're trying to consolidate.
That matters.
What the 1% wants, what the ruling class wants, above all, is some certainty in life.
I mean, we all do. Don't we all?
Don't we all, though? But
their way of deriving it is...
But we don't have fortunes. We don't have fortunes to maintain. I mean, there have been times in the history of capitalism where because of bad government choices, depressions hit and people lose everything. You know, you had businessmen jumping off of tall buildings during the crash of 1929.
No, that's a myth. That didn't happen.
They don't want anything like that happening again.
That didn't happen.
People did commit suicide.
There were a few, but then it was overblown. Like, oh, it was many, but it was just like two or something.
So,
just want to point that out.
The point being,
there was a perception that people wanted all these bankers to die.
The point is that
they didn't.
The more libertarian and Tea Party wing of the Republicans and the Trump wing, they're unreliable to the capitalist class, and they don't want things like government shutdowns. Mm. They don't want the gridlock.
Oh no!
They don't want.
Neither do the capitalists abroad. They're like, what's with the shutdowns during the Obama administration? You know, you had like, what's wrong? What's wrong with America? These are Chinese contacts of the dean of my school, where he was talking about, like, you know, when I talk to people from abroad, they're like, you know, what's wrong with America? Like, something terribly wrong that your government shuts down.
Yeah,
that would be unthinkable anywhere else.
It undermines our position as leaders of the free world.
Maybe we have a political crisis with our various parties, let's say if it's a parliamentary system, but it like doesn't shut down. Like, it still gets funded. It's about who's in charge of the next thing that's done, not what's usually done.
So big business, I'm sure, is looking at the moderate Democrats as
more
reliable than your rabidly right-wing Republicans.
Accessory story is from Daily News. This is the Bureau Chief of Albany for the Daily News, Kenneth Lovett. And there we go. See, I was doing it again while speaking right into the mic. President Trump, Governor Cuomo have tremendous amount of donors in common.
Which we thought... When I read that headline, I was like, oh, this is Trump's talk, right? He's the guy who uses tremendous and fabulous.
No, that's just
the
way.
He's the one who has the best.
That's
words.
The way Lovett was writing it.
Yes.
That's just Lovett was just making fun of Trump in that way. But basically just pointing out that it's all one class. You know, you have all of these people, bankers, even Scaramucci and all the people. They're getting, you know, it's just they have the same donors, the same rich people. Same friends, even the Clintons and the Trumps. I mean, they go to each other's weddings. That's been pointed out.
Just to clarify that Scaramucci was a donor to Cuomo and a donor to Trump, and even Trump's for a brief moment in time there, his press secretary. Am I right about that?
Yeah. Now something about the Daily News article that I'm pointing out here is so this is something that's also been pointed out by Nixon. So she's going after Cuomo because of like he takes. You want to elect somebody who's basically in the same group as Trump, basically. They're all the same friends. They're all being funded the same way. Real estate lobby. Yeah, versus New Yorkers. And so it doesn't really even quote her. It's just, and I'm going after Lovett here as a political writer, as a news writer here. And then he spends the rest of the article quoting Cuomo aides rebuffing Nixon.
Yeah, she's no good.
Can you guess the kind of things they say?
You can't do rewrites political arena.
Let's see.
So
they basically say, like, they say that these people who give the Cuomo also gave to all the other Democrats.
Yeah.
So it's like... Yeah, so it's kind of it's everyone.
A bunch of Republicans as well.
They just list Obama and Clinton as being like, well, you know, they also give Obama and Clinton. Are you against that? Yes. Let's see. Oh, they also call Nixon a silly revisionist. If it's Tuesday, I'm not even going to quote it. They should just shut up. Oh, yeah, and they keep phrasing everything.
Well,
bashing her actress as an actress right. By saying rewrites might work in Hollywood, but they don't work in the real world.
Right. That's a good zinger, right?
Oh, and yeah.
This is part of why Nixon doesn't stand a chance, is because her message is very wishy-washy. She says one thing one week, she says another thing another. Cuomo's team are slick, professional politicians. Those guys are on message. They do not waver. They have meetings about what's the best one-liner to give to the Daily News that they know they'll print. And
apparently Nixon's team doesn't have a one-liner. Or rather, if they did, and I assume they had a press release, a full press release, Lovett here isn't quoting it.
But you,
why choose the – you know, why choose – well, I mean, the reason is obvious. Lovett spends most of his day around Como's people, mm-hmm. asking them in person, and he doesn't. And a challenger, he's not hanging around their office in New York. He's up here in Albany.
Yep, he can't be known as the Nixon guy. He can't be known as the guy fighting fair, because then the people who don't want to fight fair aren't going to give him information, and then he can't write his articles, and then he hasn't got a job. And that's the pressure of being a worker in the news industry under capitalism.
It's more than just the location, like the locality of people, and that's social interactions and social power. But there's also just that Como's war chest allows him to have the ability to put out the messaging in mass that any challenger or alternative cannot. Now, Nixon and any other someone running as a Democrat, and this is one of those reasons they say we have to run as Democrats, because there's more of a donor base. There's more people who will give, and there's already a kind of a baked-in email list and the voting list or whatever.
Yep.
That the Green Party doesn't have or whatever. We actually have to build that ourselves, and that takes a decade. It's mostly thankless work. You'll thank by some people, but it's not like a drove in crowds. So I want to. Just a last few minutes, wrap up the hour by talking about the Green Party. The New York Times actually covered our national event in Salt Lake.
Oh, that's good.
It is. Don't know. It's probably not going viral, but it's Green Party eyeing 2020 presidential race prepares for midterms. Actually, no, it's just preparing for the midterms. But yes, we're talking about who we run. Now, some things
in 2020, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, that people have to start. The people who want to run in 2020 are already planning it now.
Yeah, you have.
They were planning it the day that Trump got elected.
Stein did, she started running in, not 2014, I guess. No, yeah, in 2014, and that's kind of what made her the defunct candidate, is that she was running for 2 years to actually build a stronger campaign, as strong as it could be. And that's a problem, because she doesn't really want to do it a third time, so she's not really gearing up for it. And similar to Howie, which is, I don't know if this counts as dirty laundry, but I mean, both of these are veteran candidates who have done it before.
Two times.
They're proven to be able to run for these higher offices.
This is Howie's third time.
But they didn't really want to. And Jill also doesn't want to do a third time. Not just because, and it's also the optics that we should have someone else. Now, there are other, I guess, Green Party people that I don't know about, right?
Because they haven't done the base building yet.
Yeah, we've been doing it for years and years, it's a slow progress. You know, we won't see it for another decade, because the last decade was filled with all of these problems and bad strategies that I don't need to go into, but it involves going along with the safe state strategy and trying to appease Democrats who may agree with the Green Party, but, oh, don't like our outsider strategy. You know, we need to work inside. So there's a lot of people that were not going to ever support us, and were going to badmouth us no matter what, that we were trying to appease, or rather just like, well, if they'll vote for us, if we're only running in the safe states. But that turned out to be a disaster. That was in 2004. So basically, blue states.
Blue states, right.
That Kerry wouldn't have lost.
Yeah, that you can't blame the Green Party for flipping things if the Green does too well. I mean,
But we can't. That is buying into the establishment's narrative that the Times kind of go into and don't really debunk at all. And maybe the Greens that they were quoting weren't that good at debunking it either.
The narrative that the Greens are spoilers and allow
Stein goes with the narrative that's just that the Dems don't own our votes, right?
Right.
And that's true and an important point. And she basically only has the time to make one point. The point I usually stick to is that there is no actual evidence for a spoiler argument in where a Green has taken votes from a Democrat. Mm-hmm. It's only happened like twice. And we're not even talking about higher offices.
No,
we're talking about state elections.
Yeah.
On the national and congressional races and whatever, It's just there's no statistical evidence polling.
The most famous example is in 2000 when Ralph Nader ran, and I think he ran a great campaign, and he would have made a great president. He was certainly the smart choice, but all these Democrats just crap on him all over the place for spoiling that election down in Florida. And Ralph, I remember the interview on Meet the Press very well. Ralph just sat back and said, look, if everybody running on the third party line, he's like, I was not the only third party guy running. If you add up all their votes and give them to Gore, he would have won as well. How come you're, why don't you have him on Meet the Press?
It's but again, that was the wrong argument.
It's because the Democrats want a scapegoat. They don't want to take responsibility for not representing the working class. This is why they're on Russia, Russia, Russia now. They can't take responsibility for not having the best message. The Greens had the best message that election. They had the best message in 2016. I think they'll have the best message in 2020. And like, if anything, I would encourage Jill Stein to suck it up. Do it again. You've got the name recognition. You were there. We need to see, like how we saw with Eugene V. Debs about 100 years ago, we need to see how the same name does cycle to cycle under the same party banner so that we get a good benchmark as to how the left is doing.
I'm kind of there, but I'm also, I've talked to random progressive type people, cool people that I meet around. And if there's any kind of silence between us and there's really nothing to talk about, I'll mention like, oh, how did you vote? Like, you know, did you ever consider voting for Stein? What did you think of her? And I usually don't get that great of a response.
Thought she was fine.
Because of all the, but the slander campaigns really worked. Now, of course, if you say, oh, well, the Green Party is a tainted brand. We don't have a good brand. Now, of course, that's only between the uninformed. So my usual thing to say, and this goes with even using the word socialist, communist, or whatever, it educate with your appeal. Don't appeal for the uneducated. And I want to wrap up by, and then now, yeah, so I lost track of my other point that I had in my head. Oh yeah, no, I want to wrap up that the ultimate thing is to go with the evidence. Mm-hmm. Even Nader in that interview was buying in that it was like that his votes were taken from Gore. They weren't, but in particular, the fact that twice as many Democrats in Florida voted for Bush.
Yep.
That itself is the angry linchpin that there are all of these Dems all the time voting for Republicans.
Yeah.
So why don't you get your own house in order before you're blaming independently minded people? Okay. That you have all these Dems that vote with the Republicans along their line for military spending.
To be bipartisan.
To bail out the banks. Everything we hate. Everything. And that's what's really infuriating. To blame the people who want something else. To want something better and not blame the people within their own team, their team, not mine, their team, the team blue, okay, who are undermining their very values that they say that they're leading with. Whew. Okay.
We're going to calm down.
Oh, come all ye citizens and hear my tale of woe, all because I voted for Ralph Nader. How I ruined the country with my choice 5 years ago. All because I voted for Ralph Nader. The Twin Towers fell and 3,000 died. All because I voted for Ralph Nader. The terrorists came and there was no place to hide. All because I voted for Ralph Nader. The Democrats voted to bomb Afghanistan. To cut back freedoms once enjoyed across the land. The party of Jefferson afraid to take a stand. All because I voted for Ralph Nader. W set his sights on Saddam in Iraq. All because I voted for Ralph Nader. The Democrats gave the okay to attack. All because I voted for Ralph Nader. The president said he'd wage eternal war, and the Democrats nodded from the Senate floor, and all the while the money dried up for the poor. All because I voted for Ralph Nader. Now color-coded warnings invade our every thought. All because I voted for Ralph Nader. Duct tape and plastic are all that we've got. All because I voted for Ralph Nader. The fires will rage throughout the Middle East. The terrorist threat will continue to increase. And war will go on, there never will be peace. All because I voted for Ralph Nader.
Okay, welcome back to the second hour of the Three Left Show. So next we're going to shift towards environmentalism, ecology, and its interactions with our system, and how we can kind of fight against it in a collective and perhaps also individualistic way, and everything in between. Okay, probably need a bench. So first, some good news. So if you are plugged into any kind of the struggle in a general sense, you will know about pipeline actions, blocking pipelines, the Black Snakes, Standing Rock, the actions in the left coast in Washington State and Oregon to block tar sands there, and the ongoing covered by this show as well, the what's going on in Canada or Clanada of trying to block all the pipelines up there from the Alberta tar sands, which, if all extracted, is game over for the climate. That means extreme weather year round, making everything much, much worse for everyone, particularly those that are not rich, like you and me.
And not rich.
So.
Wish I was. So I could spread the wealth a little bit, but I'm not rich.
Yeah. Well, if we were rich, we wouldn't. Spreading the wealth would be the least of on our minds. So just a quick story about here in Albany, which is one of the linchpins for the North Dakota tar sands. Not hearing that in the news as much anymore, though, because it's all, well, Alberta's the big one. But the others, you know, the North Dakota oil boom, which I think has hit its nadir, which means it's in decline. Or is it? I don't know. But maybe its decline is more that more of this is happening, where the markets are turning against it as well. But for the most part, because the price has gone up, making it harder and harder to sell. But one oil company, Global, has abandoned its tar sands facility here in Albany. So we were having the bomb trains or the oil trains coming from North Dakota, long, long trains. So it's like a pipeline on wheels on the trains, on the tracks. And it was blocking up the port. They're leaking methane, affecting our communities of color, which are live in the downtown area. And that was before even the Global was proposing to build a facility to heat up the tar sands so that it could be put on ships and sailed down the Hudson. So they don't have to build. And then there are all these other gas pipelines and stuff that have to do with frack gas. So that's the other kind of fights going on around here. But otherwise, there was a multi-year struggle which consisted to block these facilities. Now, part of it was that the DNC did its job, the Department of Environmental Conservation in New York. They did their job but first they needed to be asked to do their job. So first there was public pressure for that, for them to actually make sure that they're regulating by asking for environmental impact and air pollution studies by Global. That adds a cost to them. Any cost that you add to these big companies is a win, because that's less profit margin for them, and it also disincentivizes, makes it too expensive for them to actually carry out what they want to carry out. Keep that in mind. That is how empires are brought down, by insurgencies. In this case, it's a nonviolent insurgency of environmentalists. People for energy independence, mostly solar, but otherwise self and residents. So this was an organizing of community groups of color. So this was not only bourgeois whites, but also working class blacks and working class whites as well, living in the South End, and young people. And so there's a mass action to block the train tracks at one point. I think that was bomb train related, but these are entitled. So it was mostly held up bureaucratically, these facilities, First, it was one big facility. Then they broke it up so they can say that each separate facility would have its own impact statement, which would put it below that line where if it was one, it was 1,000. So they break it up in three. So each one is like 300 units of pollution, put it that way. I don't need to go through all of this, but I will link to the story so you can read up on it. So it was multi-part. I don't think it involved any lawsuits or having any kind of litigation, but there was direct actions. It was kind of one of those insider-outsider kind of conglomerations where you have activists. So this was an activist kind of project. The organization organizing mostly had to do with getting different groups who were already existing. And a lot of these groups are cliques, and that is kind of a problem with activist and organizing culture, is that it's all cliques. This is something we'll come back to every episode. How to organize effectively when you usually just end up with a bunch of cliques. And I'll talk and we'll discuss kind of how to go forward with that, but as far as I'll just make it a observation. Getting these cliques to work together, which, of course, when there's a common goal, like stopping tar sands facility and making the port even more polluting than it already is with all of the oil it already processes. There's getting all the municipalities on board, getting all of the elected officials. These are all Dems. Some of them are more actually environmentalist minded. Others just want to be greenwashed themselves and appear environmentalist, like our county executive. Do they really care? Probably not. But they do not want to piss off all of these party activists, because they are environmental activists, but they're also all party activists as much as well. They are solid Dems. They'll support Green Party candidates here and there, but not officially, not in a capacity where they'll wear Green Party swag and stuff, because they're registered Dems, and they don't plan on changing that. They feel that voting in primaries for, say, the Dem that is more environmentally conscious is more important than having an independent alternative. Since, you know, our local elections aren't completely corporate dominated, though it is present. So I just want to start with that little story of that victory of that they abandoned their plans because it was just made too costly by all of these activists being rabble-rousing. But it part of their victory is organizing and working with the four Black and minority communities in the South End that were most affected. And now the fight has shifted to the trucks going in and out of the port. Many hundreds of trucks every day. It's a lot of air pollution, diesel, these aren't biogas, biodiesel trucks. And then, of course, all of these kids get asthma and higher health costs, affects their working life. Not something, you know, again, and then it's individualized. Oh, these kids have asthma. They must be huff and pain or something. I don't know what conservatives say about that, and I don't care to listen to them. So we'll start, and this will bleed into the next one, I think, because I actually do want to read more of this. So this is from Erfer. I thought I was linking this from Gizmodo, but oh, yes, it is. But Erfer, I guess, is a subset of the, I forget what it's all, it's literally a media empire with all these different sites like Kotaku, Jezebel, The Root, The Onion, Clickhole, Deadspin, AV Club, each covering a different section of life. And this one's Erfer, so I guess they cover the environmental issues.
Erfer?
Erfer, yes. Okay. Not Flat Erfer, just Erfer.
We don't want any Flat Earthers here, oh my goodness.
People believe all sorts of odd things when there aren't better narratives out there, part of why we're here. So this one is called Lawns Are an Ecological Disaster. So we're talking lawns, we're talking lawn landscaping. Now, my training is in architecture, so I have quite a bit of knowledge about this training. So I love talking about the built environment. The built environment is the catch-all term that architects, planners, and so on use to refer to our cities, our towns, basically the things that humans make that we live in and work in. the built environment. So to refer to our cities as an environment unto themselves. In ecology, now ecology is like the food system. An ecology doesn't exist without a diversity of things happening in it. It is a system. It is complex and complex. Let's say, as a Vulcan would put it, infinite diversity and infinite combinations. And that makes us stronger and better. So this is written by Ian Graeber Stihel. So it starts with Neil Tyson, the astronomer, astrophysicist, actually, often conjectures that many aliens have concluded humans aren't intelligent enough to contact. He's probably referring to our capacity for war, but lawns may display our talent for fruitless carnage even better.
Lawns, I hate lawns. I'm just, before we go any further, I hate lawns. Mm-hmm. I hate mowing the lawn. I'm glad I don't have to anymore ever since I moved into the city.
I hate cars as well, but we'll focus on lawns.
We'll focus
for
on
now.
This. Just, I had to get that off my chest.
Go ahead. Americans devote 70 hours annually. I guess this is the average American, so maybe some are devoting more.
Some people go more.
70 hours annually to pushing petrol-powered spinning deck blades over aggressively pointless green carpets to meet an embarrassingly destructive beauty standard based on a facetious homogeneity. Homogeneity refers to the fact that we have one type of grass everywhere. It is the same species of grass. And that is also called a monoculture. One culture planting. We marvel at how verdant we manage to make our overwatered, chemically soaked, verdant just being lively, I guess, chemical soaked, ecologically sterile backyards. Sterile as in it is just one thing only. It's just biblically, nay, God of warish violence. To understand that the sheer inanity of devoting 40 million acres, nearly half as much land as we set aside for our biggest crops, I guess they're referring to corn, half as much land is devoted to corn as lawns, to an incredible, inedible carpet, we need to back up beyond modern lawns' origins with the real estate family peddling of the American dream, a myth, by the way. I don't know why American dream is still being used in rhetoric.
Some people still buy it.
Is it still being used by the DSA? I'm confused by this.
I don't know.
I feel like I'm hearing it in left circles of the American. Maybe they're just liberal circles. As whites only cookie-cutter suburbs to the evolution of grass. Devoted to this grass. Most plants grow from the top, according to the standard. So now it goes into some background.
I learned something here.
Yes. So let's learn something about grass. And I'm not talking about pot or marijuana. Talking about actual grass.
Actual grass.
Yes. Let's learn about grass, people. Most plants grow from the top, according to Santa Barbara Botanical Garden Director Steve Winhanger, expert they went to see. Grasses, on the other hand, always grow from the base. Hey. From the plant's perspective, this is a great strategy for dealing with grazers who'd randomly hit the same patch every few months.
Meaning grazing animals.
Yes.
You know, quadrupeds, bison.
Eating the grass, just cutting it to put in bags.
Beings that get an actual use out of this stuff.
Yes, but Americans, true to form, are much more glutinous. We mow our lawns every few weeks. This coaxes our grass into growing its roots outward rather than down, spawning more sprawling shoots in hopes of enabling any one blade to avoid overzealous grazers. However, I love how he's inserting the stats just into the explanation here. However, the almost $50 billion to $82 billion we spend annually on overcutting and landscaping, FYI, we spend that same amount in foreign aid, effectively amounts to trying to kill the grass while offering it life support. We trap it in prepubescence. Too young to reseed, racing desperately ever outward to find reproductive refuges that don't exist. Mm-hmm. We cut ourselves equally, though. 35,000 people, that's the same amount who are killed in car accidents, 4,800 of which are children, are treated annually for mower-related injuries.
And this, I want to make a point, that this whole paragraph just really brought things home, and this was the point at which I was like, aha. I'm starting to notice some family dynamics going on here, right? Because when I was living with my dad on unemployment and waiting for my disability case to finally kick in, which it thankfully has, one of the big sticking points in our relationship was the lawn. and getting it mowed, and the fact that in order for me to be living at home and pull my weight, I was stuck in this kind of prepubescent battle that the lawn was my responsibility. And even if it didn't have to be cut, according to me, it still had to be cut. And I was like, what if I hurt myself mowing the lawn?
So you hate lawns for a very personal reason.
And I'm sure a lot
of... lawn wronged you.
I'm sure Americans do.
Show me where it touched you.
No. I'm sure a lot of young Americans, and this is part of the strict father model of doing things. One of the reasons that the lawn exists isn't just for an American dream, white, nice mowed long picket fence. It's a way for parents to control their children and instill within them the work ethic, right? Yes. You mow the lawn.
The necessary work ethic, though.
Or if you want a summer job, get a lawnmower and start mowing lawns. Or if you're an unskilled laborer, what can you do? Suburbs have them all over the place. You landscape. It's one of the easiest things you can start up a business and do.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. In the old suburban developments, some of the families, you could tell the ones that had money were the ones that had every week the same landscaping company.
Oh, well, yeah. Company, come in, yeah.
Just but, come but in
kids,
and
kids, though. Can kids do this?
Oh, right? Yeah. And
anyway. We were talking about our hatred, shared hatred, personal or otherwise, of lawns.
Lawns.
The last stat that we left off on was that lawn care causes many injuries, and get this. So
how many injuries do they cause?
It was 35,000 people, same number killed by cars, but I guess they're not being killed, obviously. But 4,800 of that 35,000 were children. So these are children that are encouraged to mow the lawn and help out with that stuff.
Just instill a work ethic into these kids by giving them super fast, super sharp blades.
So 600 of these resulted in youth amputations. So, you know, what about the children? What about the children? Now, let's keep in mind the people, kids maimed by guns and other such things is less or equal to. Nearly eight times more Americans. Okay, so this was the Royal Statistical Society from the UK, I assume. So they had their International Statistic of the Year award, and it went to the fact that eight times more Americans are killed by lawnmowers than by Islamic terrorists. Mm-hmm.
And yet no one's afraid, right, to mow their lawn. Like when I would go out to mow the lawn almost every time, because lots of lawns, especially in smaller, cramped suburban areas, are kind of tricky to mow.
It's framed as a choice is why. So when being attacked by a terrorist is framed as not being a choice, even though it actually kind of is, because we choose to invade and occupy other countries. And that's just a natural reaction to it.
Well,
just like how getting your arm chopped off by a motor blade is a natural reaction to being around lawnmowers enough.
Yes. And I'm sure that there's a class element here, like I was talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. The families that have enough money to hire landscapers to come out and mow their lawns real nice every week,
they will not get in.
They want a working class guy to take the risk that the blade gets stuck or a slope, or they fall down a slope and into the lawnmower or something. They don't want to have to deal with the upkeep and maintenance of a mower. They make the working class do it.
Isn't there the intersectional aspect, though, that these lawn care companies are also using foreign and migrant labor, which keep their costs down?
A lot of them do.
So when you say that kids can,
a lot of them do.
Kids can't compete with that.
Nope.
Or a local guy like me, if I start one. Now, I did see some guys who do this ecological landscaping. I'd like to actually see if I can work with them.
Well, and it's also framed as an individual choice whether or not to cut your lawn at all. But
it is.
Society is very coercive here.
No, there are
there's neighborhood associations that will fine you.
And municipalities have
there are some laws on
ordinances that can be, and it's not that it's written out, but then they are. This was the case with a Canadian municipality. It was a story I don't have in front of me, but it was this professor who's a cool dude, and he didn't want to cut his lawn. He just let it grow out. And he kind of sold it as an art project almost. It had to be. And it just became tall grass. And the municipality basically fined him and ordered him to mow his lawn using the interpretation of an ordinance that he was blocking the sidewalk because some of the grass was touching it. Mm-hmm. So not really a choice, in most places, and even here, I don't know, in Albany, neighbors will complain, though, and then the council will, you know, it's like, why isn't this person being fined? I see that on Facebook all the time. And yet, Winghanger, the guy from the Botanical Garden, himself participated in a study that found that by switching to a mix of native grasses, reducing waterings, and eliminating fertilization, we could slow lawn growth and only need to mow around every 2 months. Ooh.
That's,
I'm not impressed.
No, so, neither are the gas companies. A lot of gasoline gets burned.
That's mentioned as well.
Wasn't there something in here about the emissions from lawnmowers? I mean,
influential native gardening writer Sarah Stein perhaps best summed up the absurdity best. Quote, continual amputation is a critical part of lawn care. Cutting grass regularly, preventing it from reaching up and flowering, forces it to sprout still more blades, more rhizomes, which is a root network, more roots, to become ever more impenetrable mat, until it is what its owner has worked so hard or paid so much to have. The perfect lawn, the perfect sealant for which nothing else can grow, and the perfect antithesis of an ecological system. According to the University of Florida ecology and conservation professor Mark Hostler, there's no hyperbole. Producing no seeds, nectar, or fruit, few creatures can use these lawns as a habitat. Biodiversity-wise, it's almost like concrete.
Yep, that was probably my favorite sentence in the article, is that once you start looking at lawns the same way you look at concrete, mm-hmm. you understand.
It's a concrete that's softer, but in that case, just use real carpet
and it looks
or
nice.
AstroTurf. I remember like watching a video of like, you know, I got tired of taking care of my lawn, so I just got AstroTurf. And it was just for maybe a portion of the area, like the area that you would actually sit on. And this kind of goes into maybe allergies. By not having bugs around your house and stuff, you know, oh, you want lawns so impenetrable that even little, you know, bugs that bite you can't live there. So you have kids sit down, they play in the grass, and they're not getting bitten up. But then they don't develop any resistance. So as mm-hmm. soon as they go into a real ecology with bugs in it, they get eaten up, and it's really bad. And maybe I've lived that living here in the city. Although our backyard actually has bugs, and we mow, but not very often. Also, like twice a month. Once every 2 months, kind of thing. Let's see. Up until the 1940s, we at least left odd flowers like clovers, which actually add nitrogen back into the soil. Very important cover crop. Then we figured out how to turn petrochemicals into fertilizer. The new goal became to have a full monoculture. One study found that in urban areas, weeds were the most popular food sources for pollinators. Now, by the way, the big con of monocultures, especially if we're talking about food production, is that they are more susceptible to pests. And if you have one type of blight, it'll take the whole thing out, and thus you need to spend and chemically soak everything to prevent that.
That's right.
So we have to poison ourselves slowly, granted. You know, the testing is just enough that the full dose doesn't kill you, but if it's spread out, then it'll kill you and give you cancer slowly, or at least over 30 years or so. These are the effects we'll see in the next 30 years, or at the moment, the higher cancer rates we have are an effect of 30, 40 years of doing this. The industrial food system. One study found that in urban areas, weeds were the most popular food source for pollinators. Weeds and native plants are especially helpful for pollinators, which contribute even more conservative estimates. $3.5 billion to our economy is what pollinators contribute, and which are vastly more threatened than honeybees. A study conducted in southeastern Pennsylvania found that native plants also increase butterfly and bird population. So this is just why we need native plants around for actual fauna and life to occur. We're included in that web of life, by the way.
Yes, we are.
In exiling animals, which brings to mind like Over the Hedge, lawns cost us too. Today's children growing up on lawns, Stein once wrote, will not even have nostalgia to guide them. And soon the animals will not only be missing, but forgotten. Kind of echoes Silent Spring.
Yep.
native grass. But again, like the effect of Silent Spring in the first, like the beginning of the environmentalist movement was to make the chemicals less toxic, right? Not to ban their use or anything. Native grasslands are a mix of cool weather and just more facts about native grasslands and how basically we need them to actually fight climate change. Lawns are really terrible for that. There's some other stats here. Let's see.
Well, native grasses. They look nice.
Native grasses. And yeah, I believe they look better. when you add everything up, lawns are definitely causing a lot more issue with climate change than preventing it. Because it's assumed that any kind of plant stores carbon, but it does so terribly, especially since we're burning fossil fuels and using all of this industry to grow it in the first place. So here's the stats on gas use. We use 580 million gallons of gas each year in lawnmowers. And these numbers are almost meaningless in how big they are. But
they're huge.
But it's a lot. They emit as much pollution in 1 hour as 40 automobiles driving, accounting for roughly 10 to 18% of non-road gasoline emissions.
This lawnmower has always struck me as horribly inefficient.
We also dump, and by the way, we're also talking about all those riding mowers that I've seen people in Albany have. We also dump roughly 10 times more fertilizer on our lawns than on crops, notes Columbia's Earth Institute. These fertilizers and these 67 million pounds of pesticides with which we drench our lawns every year degrade, releasing compounds like nitrous oxide, one of the greenhouse gases, which is about 300 times more potent than CO2. Potential damages from agricultural fertilizer runoff alone are estimated by one study to cost $157 billion annually. How is it made causing damage? Health damage to us, damage to all these other systems, and probably hurting other growers or something.
And ultimately,
I have to look into that.
Ultimately, the lawn just exists to sell commodities, to sell lawn,
sell the house,
to sell gas, to increase the property value of the house.
Yeah, to sell the house, basically.
Yeah,
it doesn't increase the use value unless you count.
It doesn't do
the need
anything
for a meadow. I mean, the lawn is based on the meadow, but the meadow is also a
ecosystem.
Constructed.
Yeah.
It's an ecosystem, but it is also a landscaped human habitat. But it has an edge of tall grass, so I would like to, for the advice of people who still need to maintain a lawn, we'll at least have an edge of tall grass and native species.
Yep.
Now, this article actually proposes the opposite, that especially once I mentioned that municipality, which was about touching the sidewalk, we'll just mow the edge of your plot,
and then have
the rest be
wild growth. Yeah,
and you have wildflowers, and you can scatter plant stuff on the cheap.
Have a natural garden.
Now for the water use. It gets better.
Oh, here we go.
All America's farmland consumes 88.5 million acre feet of water a year. Now, that's a metric I haven't heard. Acre feet?
Acre feet. That's an interesting unit of measurement. Yeah.
They use gallons later. Lawns with a fraction of the land drink an estimated 2/3 as much. Most municipalities use 30 to 60% of drinkable water on lawns.
So in some cases, the majority of water that could go for drinking, cooking, washing gets used on these stupid patches of green that just make you feel good.
That some kids are not even playing on, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Some do. But that's it gets to that, where some of the collective solution is to just limit where lawns are to the ball fields,
parks,
the parks, and other common areas where the kids can then play. Let's see. California is even special. If you thought Trump tweets made no sense, LA, prior to the big drought, 70% of your water loss came courtesy of lawns. Water use throughout California seems to be rebounding, though, to pre-drought levels. So lawns are soaked once more. First, so how do we combat this? So first, we limit lawns to where we actually need them.
We just touched upon that.
You can individually, if you are a land homeowner, introduce your mowing and fertilizing. Better yet, switch to native grasses. Let them reseed themselves. Let the clover live. To avoid annoying the local homeowner association, make your native lawn look manicured. For example, if you just maintain a circle of mowed area around a taller grass area, it makes it clear that this was an intentional design state. You know, he's not a designer because he calls it a design state. Mm-hmm. You could just call it intentional choice or strategy. In a few states, such as Texas and Florida, homeowner associations can't fine you for not maintaining your lawn this stupid way, provided you do not say you do so to save water. Okay, so if you say you're saving water, they can't fine you. Others, like California, offer programs that pay to replace your lawn with a native plants, and by switching to native plants or desert style landscaping, also referred to as zisterscaping, you know, you won't remember that.
No,
we could also put a dent in the estimated 9 billion gallons of water we use in our yards every day.
It's a lot of water every day.
Want to tell your homeowner station to sit on their sprinkler and spin? Many states have an even more obscure program. Replace your lawn with all native plants. Certify it for your local Department of Natural Resources as a wildlife habitat.
Sounds like a lot of paperwork.
And then get a property tax exemption. It is. It would
probably
be
a lot easier to just go with the flow and mow the lawn. Yeah.
Imagine. It's cheaper to do all this wasteful bunk than to work with the public good for the public good with the state. The state isn't very good at actually helping people with the public good.
Also disciplines the working class and steals time away from them. Right, like. You can't go out and organize, you know, community events and such if you're just stuck with a huge lawn that you got to mow every weekend.
Or diversity of chores that could be handled collectively or in a group fashion.
True.
Co-housing and other types of collective housing arrangements, which can still have individual units, by the way. Okay. Not full commune, but co-housing is where you have your own flat and you share you still have your own kitchen, but you also have like a big kind of meeting, a common space, lounge, where you can have all kinds of cool stuff. And then you can have a working group that handles landscaping, and that can change out so that, you know, you don't have to handle it all the time. So that's its last kind of... Oh, yeah. I've also heard lawns... So this is the last quote from Winghanger. I've heard lawns compared to a biological desert. That's really unfair. Because deserts can be very diverse places.
Yep.
So start searching now, because soon, as you start mowing, you're paying for green concrete.
Yeah, that's basically what lawns are.
Okay, I just prefer not to drive. But
we're back, yes.
But a lot of jobs do require it, and that is one of those ways that our economic system prevents so much good that could be happening, and it's really in spite of ourselves that any of us are able to do things that are kind and good. So kudos if you are. So now I'm going to throw it to you, Colin, for our last segment. You're going to cover a piece from the Monthly Review.
Yeah, the Monthly Review is...
what is that?
The Monthly Review is, as it says on the cover, it's an independent socialist magazine. And it's actually been around for quite some time. This is volume 70, issue number 3 for July, August 2018. They've been around publishing socialist and Marxist scholarly academic style articles since like the 50s. I'd heard of them before, and I was encouraged to subscribe by a comrade in the Socialist Party. And this is the second issue I've received. They're very good, very in-depth articles, citations and everything. And unlike Jacobin, it's small. There's no pictures. It's not flashy or anything.
Half of the value of Jacobin is the art.
Yeah.
I like the art, though.
Yeah.
We need more art.
It has its place. Yeah. Jacobin is kind of a entry-level, I would call it, socialist magazine. This periodical, you kind of have to have a little bit of basis in Marxist theory.
So you're immediate.
Critical theory, that sort of
immediate
thing.
Level. It's the square. It's the blue square.
Yeah.
That's a skiing reference.
We don't have to go into the whole issue this month. Is if you consider yourself a green, an environmentalist, the whole issue this month is
care
titled,
about plants.
It's titled The Robbery of Nature. Mm-hmm. And it talks about Marx's idea of capitalism and the metabolic rift I'm just going to read
one.
What
does that mean?
I'm just going to read like...
Yeah, read an excerpt for us.
One quick excerpt. This is the introduction to the introduction.
Okay.
So it's just a few paragraphs. And it's by John Bellamy Foster and Brett Clark.
If you want to jump in, I'll raise my hand.
Yeah, yeah. And it starts off, the chapter on machinery and large-scale industry in the first volume of Karl Marx's Capital closes with this statement. All progress in capitalist agriculture is progress in the art, not only of robbing the worker, but robbing the soil. Capitalist production, therefore, only develops the techniques and degree of combination of the social process of production by simultaneously undermining the original sources of all wealth, the soil and the worker, end quote. Robbing the worker referred to the theory of exploitation, which entailed the expropriation of the worker's surplus labor by the capitalist. But what did Marx mean by robbing the soil? Here, robbery was connected to his theory of the metabolic rift arising from the expropriation of the earth. As he stated earlier in the same paragraph, quote, capitalist production disturbs the metabolic interaction between man and earth, i.e., it prevents the return to the soil of its constituent elements consumed by man in the form of food and clothing. Hence, it hinders the operation of the internal natural condition for the lasting fertility of the soil, end quote. The same basic logic was present in the other famous passage on the metabolic rift at the end of the chapter on the genesis of capitalist ground rent in the third volume of Capital. There Marx referred to, quote, the squandering of the vitality of the soil, unquote, by large-scale capitalist enterprise, generating a, quote, irreparable rift in the interdependent process of social metabolism, a metabolism prescribed by the natural laws of life itself, unquote. In both instances, Marx's notion of the robbery of the soil is intrinsically connected to the rift in the metabolism between human beings and the earth. To get at the complexities of his metabolic rift theory, it is therefore useful to look separately at the issues of the robbery and the rift, seeing these as separate moments in a single development. This is best done by examining how Marx's ecological critique in this area emerged in relation to the prior critique of industrial agriculture provided by the celebrated German chemist Justus von Liebig.
And what was that?
That was of particular importance in this context as Liebig's notion of the, quote, robbery system or Raub system.
Okay.
Of robbery economy, Raubwirtschaft, which he associated with British high farming. Final paragraph here. For Marx, as for Liebig, this robbery was not, of course, confined simply to external nature, since humans as corporeal beings were themselves part of nature. We're part of nature, too. Mm-hmm. The expropriation of nature in capitalist society had its counterpart, in Marx's analysis, in the expropriation of human bodily existence. The robbery and the rift in nature's metabolism was also a robbery and a rift in human metabolism. This was visible in the many forms of bonded labor, in the conditions of social reproduction in the patriarchal household, and in the destructive physical impacts and loss of vital powers of individual human beings.
Can you speak to what's meant when they use the word metabolism?
And the article goes on, metabolism being like, in humans,
just general life.
The food that you eat,
okay.
The rest that you get between working. And so the article goes on, it's, you know, a few pages.
The basics
and
of life.
It sets up the whole magazine. And it takes a lot of good examples about robbing from nature and robbing, you know, because human beings are part of nature, robbing human beings' life force. And so the big example that it used in an example to British high farming in the 1850s was how industrial grade farming just sapped the soil of all of its nutrients. And then landowners had this
problem. By not doing crop rotation, they were maximizing their profits.
Crop rotation
short term.
Yes.
So they weren't crop rotating. They weren't using, let's say, cover crops like clover. Clover is a great... So a cover crop, to give you some agricultural knowledge, drop that. So you plant cover crops over when you're not... You alternate fields like crop rotation. And when you're not planting, say, corn, you plant clover, and clover puts nitrogen and other nutrients back into the soil.
That's correct. That
recharges it.
So the quick and easy method that they found to replenish nutrients in the soil was to
use things like fertilizer.
And what was a really good form of fertilizer was guano. And this was imported from Peru. So all the way from Peru,
yeah.
to Great Britain just to replenish the soil for industrial farming.
I knew of this from a environmental history of South America class. That was my context here. And it was a little bit that we covered about an island made of bird crap.
Yes, yes.
Completely made of bird crap, collected over centuries, if not millennium. And so it was an entire island, a mountain of bird crap.
Now, here's my question.
And it was all extracted. All the workers died of horrible diseases and illness.
And that is where we get into the corporeal rift of stealing. Like, it's not that the workers were killed. It's that their life power was stolen from them by the capitalists so they could replenish the soil because they were robbing from nature. It was a robbery from nature in both instances. People need to think of things like that. This is what we mean by exploitation of the workers. I mean, the reason these workers died was because they were fed so little and allowed to rest so little that they just, some of them killed themselves. Would jump
and it wasn't a market choice they were making.
It wasn't a market choice. And
they conscripted into it? I forget how.
A lot of this was bonded labor, and it was workers from China.
They have some debt, and thus to pay off the debt, they must work for this.
And it was migrant labor, and
how they got the debt hooked on drugs. I don't know, but a lot of things.
And they were paid so little that they had really nothing else to do with their lives but work. And maybe sleep a few hours and then eat like a bowl of rice and no vegetables and beans.
And that's susceptible to all the diseases of working in a mountain.
And this is just looking at things in this way is like, I really wish a lot more environmentalists and greens, these people get really revved up when they see the robbery of nature and the destruction of the natural environment because it's so beautiful. But I see only a few of them look at human beings the same way, you know.
Well, many environmental movements, since the 60s can muster is we need to regulate the corporations. But by their very nature, they need to extract as much as possible.
And right?
They must steal because they're funded via a, financial system that only funds them if they steal, right? They can't just make a net and extract just enough.
Yes, but the main idea
put things back in is a cost that can, unfeasible according to the banker. Mm-hmm.
But the main idea here is who are they stealing from? And too many environmentalists get caught up in the fact that you can only steal from nature. The fact of the matter is
stealing from us.
That they're stealing from human beings because human beings are a part of nature.
And that nature's land, which commonly owned, would be ideally shared by everyone.
And it used to be.
And it used to be.
It used to be under primitive communism, but then you developed systems of slavery where you stole
just
a person's entire life.
Even in feudal times, there were commons and a lot of struggles
feudalism
in those
came
eras.
Out of slavery, and then capitalism arose out of feudalism.
Yes.
The historical materialist analysis of Marx and later Lenin was that capitalism was going to have to run into
which is fancy for looking what actually happened.
Yeah, it would run into material conditions where you can't steal anymore from either the worker or from nature, and a change would have to happen, and that change was socialism.
You can see American history as being you can interpret American history like this. As soon as we couldn't extract the oceans and the East Coast anymore, we had to move west, and they have to keep moving west. And then once we're done, we can't extract and make a profit off of extracting from California and Washington anymore. Then we need territories and islands and
then
all the other stuff.
Then you need imperialism. Right.
Right.
That this is the highest phase of capitalism, according to Lenin. And we've seen this might not be correct because we still have capitalism. I mean, we mentioned on the show a couple of times here, and it's very in vogue to say we are in late stage capitalism. Which is a hopeful thing to say because hopefully this is the last stage, right? Hopefully we will finally move towards a post-capitalist system.
Right.
I don't know if we're there yet.
It's rhetorical to call it late capitalism.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's called sometimes hyper-capitalism, or that's why neoliberalism exists.
Well,
new liberalism from earlier, last century.
This is part of the philosophy of history. You don't know that something is history until it has already happened. You know, it's calling something late stage capitalism assumes that we know the entire trajectory of the history of capitalism is going to be even into the future.
Yeah.
And speaking, this is what a lot of Eastern philosophy, specifically Buddhist, gets
into. Not a wise thing to do.
You can't predict the future. It's never going to match up to your expectations. We might not be in late stage capitalism. We can't even predict is global climate change going to be as catastrophic as it's predicted to be. It could be more catastrophic. It could be less catastrophic, and we've got more time to adapt. This is the big question mark of our times. Have we robbed enough from nature that nature is now going to wreak its revenge against us? You know, and is it going to happen during the 2020s really fast, faster than anyone? Is it going to happen by the end of the century when our grandkids have to deal with this?
There are certain types.
We just don't know.
Yeah, there are certain types of acceleration happening in areas that aren't coming to mind at the moment. But I'm sure I'll leave it to you, the listener, to think about your daily life and what seems to be moving faster, what isn't, what's stagnant, what doesn't seem to be changing, and how we can collectively and find the like-minded around you. You know, break the taboos, bring up politics, and if you counter the people who don't want to talk it, then fine, leave it at that. Mm-hmm. They're not helping. They're not going to help.
Yeah, and
but then you'll find the people who do want to talk about the problems at work and the problems. And then you could talk about doing something, having a study group or looking to it yourself. Just
study groups,
just
yes.
A little bit, an hour or so.
Do it
you
yourself.
Know.
Do study philosophy.
If you instead of watching that hour of Netflix, you watch that hour of Netflix, but instead of 2 hours of Netflix, then what? Do something else for an hour.
Watch a lecture on Marx's Capital.
Yeah, I mean, I'm this week in the next month. You know, I'm going to devote an hour every day to doing some doodling, learning how to draw cartoons. Particularly, just I want to draw people better. Both.
You got ideas to make political cartoons, Dan?
No, but I suppose I want to develop these skills so that it's open. I think it's for the graphics portion of it that when I design a flyer, I want to be able to have a cartoon version of myself, and I've yet to be able to kind of. I've got one version of it, but I want something that's even sharp, like more edgy, something that looks more like the styles that's on TV. And stuff like that.
Nothing wrong with that. But before we run out of time, I just want to stress again that this publication, Monthly Review, is probably the best socialist publication out there that has been around for a long time and puts out consistently good stuff. Mm-hmm. And if you are a green, this is
sounds wordy, but
this is a great. This is a great. Oh yeah, it's wordy. It's dense stuff and. Mm-hmm.
But you learn a lot by
you learn a lot struggling with these texts.
This is how learning actually happens.
It's challenging.
Just like in school, you have something that with words you don't know, and you look up those words. The internet allows you to do this very easily. So, or you look up a certain word like metabolism, and the dictionary will give you all the different versions that people use that word. Mm-hmm. Or you could type in the word and Marxism, and then you'll get an article that could be better, you know, more
and there's,
written.
There's lots of small books out there
in a way that can that's more comfortable.
There's lots of little books out there that you can buy, like Introducing Marxism from the Icon Books Graphic Guide series, Oxford's A Very Short Introduction series, even just Wikipedia. Just go check out.
Oh yeah, yeah. Just Wikipedia and
just Wikipedia.
TV
Marxism.
Tropes is good. TV Tropes is a really really good articles actually. Oddly enough, it's such a weird place to go to, but TV Tropes explains the cultural ideas of everything, and it's all cataloged really well.
Probably influenced by Marxism as well.
I'm going to play leave out some music, so I'm just going to play us out on that and cover that we are on all the podcast apps, iTunes, well, not all of them, but the big three, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. Our website is 3less.news, nothing else. And there's the Facebook page, also just the Three Left Show. And you can also, we have a page on Patreon if you so choose. We really could use the support. These mics need to be replaced with condenser mics so it's not picking up that hum behind me and all that other stuff and the table.
We're starting small.
Because this is a community radio station on a shoestring budget. We really need the support. We can have it's only our media if it's ours. Just like how we were ranting about our political system that is not ours because we do not pay for it in taxes or otherwise. Okay, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.